brave amigos are we. Brother to brother and everyone, a brave amigo. Wherever they need us, our destinies lead us. Amigos, we're always together. Wherever we go, we'll be brave amigos, and we'll be amigos forever. We are the three amigos. We are the three amigos. We are the three amigos, and amigos forever.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Three Amigos. Watching it with me is Graham Sibley. Hi, Graham, how are you?
Hello, Rich. I'm good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me back onto the show.
No, it's my pleasure, and welcome back. This is your return after the previous Airplane episode.
Yep.
Now, when we discussed other podcasts that you like to do, this was one of the ones that came up. What's so special about Three Amigos for you?
Well, I think it probably hit me at a good time. Three Amigos came out in the summer of 1987, and that was just after I finished my A-levels and just before I started work. So I had 2 months off of doing pretty much what 18-year-olds do when they've got nothing else to do. They're just lazing around, hanging around with my mates, going to the cinema and watching daft films, and this was a particularly daft film. So I have it was a good period of my life, and this was a very, very funny film, and it hit me just at the right time, I think.
Well, that's one of the things I've sort of talking to people about the film sort of over the last few months about it, and when it comes up every so often, is it's one of those that people tend to be very fond of it, and yet it doesn't register always on people's sort of all-time favourite films, all-time favourite comedies, etc. And I mean, someone told me when I mentioned I was watching it the other day, they said it was one that, I wasn't sure whether to agree with them or not, but it was almost less than the sum of its parts. And yet, I watched it for the first time probably a couple of years after it came out. I think it had been on BBC One on a Sunday night or something like that. And I watched it with my younger brother, and it was just kind of, you know, that everything from the songs, the famous salute that they do, every scene, it just blew me away as a kid, or sort of younger, but young teenager at the time. And coming back to it now, you know, 30 odd years later, and watching it, and so much of it still rang a bell that, like you said off air, the earworms of the songs and the bits that suddenly twig in your head. I mean, there's just so much in there that I loved it then, and watching it again, I reminded me of how much I still love it now.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how it is. You can say it's been forgotten, but when you mention it to people, it immediately springs to mind. But if you ask them what their favourite Steve Martin film is, for instance, they'll list out a lot of other films, and they may come up with Three Amigos. If they say, what if you ask them, what's your favourite cowboy comedy film, you'll probably say Blazing Saddles, and all these other things. But this film is just a very, very funny film, and I think you're right. Where people say, oh, it's not as good as the sum of its parts, I can see what they mean. If you look at it with an analytical mind, you can see the gaps in it, and you can see the problems that there might have been going on in the background. But for me, I think I look at it and I think, well, no, this isn't about analysing this film, even though that's what we're going to do for the next hour or so. But it's more about just letting it wash over you, because this is just a barrel of laughs, and that's all it really paints itself to be. and it worked so well. And it worked so well, they've remade it twice, completely differently.
And I wonder if, you know, that there's a lot of elements here that we're almost kind of going back to when you were last on, and I always find it amusing when people come back on a second or third time as a guest and there are links to the previous film. I mean, we're talking about a film that's scored by Elmer Bernstein.
Yeah.
Again, and while this isn't a straight lift as much as Airplane was of Zero Hour, there's so many elements of this film that are heavily, heavily built upon previous movies as well.
Sure.
And everything about it, I mean, you know, like you said, you know, what people's favourite Steve Martin movie is. I mean, we're talking, you know, 1986 when it was made. You know,
yeah.
Steve Martin and Chevy Chase were huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely giant names. And you know, again, Martin Short, I read this was his first sort of starring role. But then, you know, as I say, without generalising, most people our sort of age will know who Martin Short is, and, you know, went on to become a very famous actor himself. And it's just wonderful watching it now, you know, with that in mind. I mean, yes, Chevy Chase, you know, for all his various, what he's turned out, and, you know, I'll always remember the Mike Reed kind of evening with him. I'll probably cut in a bit where someone shouts, "Mike Reed, you're a twat." But,
Mike Reed, you're a twat!
You know, watching this again, the chemistry between the three of them was fantastic from the start, and we'll always just have that opening number. The film opens with the Orion logo, which is always a sign of quality in this world.
Especially on this podcast.
If it's Orion or Canon, it's clearly a thumbs up. The three of them singing the opening song and holding that note for 13 or 14 seconds.
Yeah,
masterpiece.
Interesting point about that holding the note thing, because the whole premise of the film was based on Steve Martin watching a Disney cartoon from the mid-40s called The Three Caballeros, which that was the original title of the film. But that note that they hold there, that is a callback to the song that Steve Martin saw and thought the whole, began the whole, well, set the ball rolling for this whole film project. It's a Donald Duck cartoon, for God's sake. But it's this weird sort of propaganda piece where Disney tries to sell its product to Latin America. And it's got this, it has this character called Jose Karaoke. And there's this big song and dance number, and one of the characters just holds this note, and it goes on forever. It goes on a lot longer than the 14 seconds that they do in Three Amigos. But I thought it was interesting. I only just saw it today. I watched it. And I thought, oh my God, that's where they got the held note gag from, and it works brilliantly. So there's a little tiny little nod to the original there, one that I think even Disney can't actually get them for.
No, I mean, I'm sure they'll try, but I mean, and this is the thing, I've literally just looked it up now. I didn't realize it's actually on Disney Plus.
Yes, so, it is. Yeah, you can watch it there. Yeah, it's about an hour long. It's like a portmanteau. There's lots of different stories in there, but it's a Donald Duck classic from the 40s.
Yeah, and if any kids are watching, beware, it apparently contains tobacco depictions. Yeah, you have been warned. Well, they did come out in 1945. So, my kids have been watching the Three Little Pigs cartoon, which I think even came out before this. So, good effort. Disney Plus is great. It's all that rubbish. I'm not paid to say that, by the way. I mean, this, you know, when you look at the credits of the film, again, we've already mentioned you've got Elmer Bernstein doing the score, songs by Randy Newman, and weirdly written by Randy Newman as well. And directed by John Landis, who, you know, I mean, this was around the time of the legal case with the deaths on the set of, was it Poltergeist or Poltergeist?
Yeah, it was Twilight Zone, the movie.
Oh, Twilight Zone, this
was actually in the middle of the trial. This is perhaps another reason why it doesn't gel together as well as it should, because he wasn't actually involved in the post-production because he was on trial.
That's not a bad excuse, really.
No, not really. But yeah, no, it was, yeah. It was quite an awful time. He was still making films at the time, which was amazing. But unfortunately, Vic Morrow was the actor who was the father of Jennifer Jason Leigh. He died. He got decapitated by a helicopter, and two child actors were killed as well, rather tragically. Extremely tragically. And and obviously there was a big fracas. This was made 3 years before. That was made 3 years before. So all of this had been rumbling on for some time. But he was, as I say, he was still making films, still making comedies as well, which was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at some of the films he did throughout the 80s, and I mean, we've talked about it before on other episodes where he's directed the film, you know, American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Coming to America. And a couple of years ago, me and my friend went to see Coming to America at the BFI, and they had a Skype Q&A with John Landis afterwards.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And, needless to say, that whole trial thing didn't come up. But it's just, when you look at, again, this might be one of those things where people think, oh, Three Amigos and Steve Martin, Chevy Chase. And I just don't buy it. I mean, from the song, and there's the whole, I mean, the film's set in 1916, but there's whole, you know, little parts of it where in the studio after the, in the village in Mexico where they go and see the silent movie that they're in. And they come out, they're all very heroic. And again, that's something that I'm sure is ripe for a remake, where people watch a movie and decide, it sounds like something out of the A-Team, isn't it? Oh, we'll hire them.
Galaxy Quest?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's I guess there's so many. I mean, that's like 20 odd years old, so.
Yeah, and Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was more of an accidental thing.
It is almost like a genre in itself. I mean, it starts off in a very sort of 80s sort of fish out of water type film, which John Landis loved, by the way. I mean, like, like things like Trading Places, but the mid 80s were awash with these fish out of water films, like The Big, Coming to America, Back to the Future, Crocodile Dundee, Star Trek IV, all of these sort of films which put
classics
from the mid 80s, where you put a character and you put him in a completely alien situation, and but it takes it one step further, and it does, it creates this mini genre that's remade every 10 years. So yeah, you've got Galaxy Quest, you've got Tropic Thunder, and that was about 10 years ago, so there's probably time for another one to come out pretty much nowish.
I think probably starring Dwayne Johnson or something. Yeah.
I think you can probably count A Bug's Life in there as well. That's probably on the outskirts of this, the mini genre.
And you know, this is a produced by Lorne Michaels. You've got in the studio when afterwards you've got John Lovitz and Phil Hartman there, you know, sort of Saturday Night Live alumni.
Oh, yeah, I mean that opening scene in the office where you've got three very, very familiar voices if you're a big fan of The Simpsons. Because you've got Joe Mantegna, haven't you? You've got Fat Tony, you've got John Lovitz, who turns up occasionally, and then you've got Phil Hartman, who Lionel Hutz and et al.
Oh, Troy McClure.
Yes.
Yeah. You may remember him, yeah. You know, this whole thing, I mean, imagine being on that set that day. You've got those three. That,
yeah.
You've got Short, Chase and Martin opposite each other, and this is you know we maybe more of a current thing. They'd have a whole backstory now and probably a prequel about the before the Three Amigos. It would be an HBO special. Steve Martin's lucky day is really giving it the big "Do you know who I am?" After one flop, they're kind of being right, we're gonna, you know, have a slight rethink now. I mean, these were the days when studios were pumping out films. I mean, Fat Tony is talking about, I'll call him Fat Tony, he's talking about turning around their next film in 8 days.
Yeah.
And when you compare that to, you know, 100 years later when they're sort of 8-month shoots, or if it's a Bond film, about 6 years. But, you know, this is probably a very good satire of the movie system at the time as well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally, and probably is a satire of the movie system as it was then as well. But of course, such is the pace of the film, is they don't dwell on anything like that. They just comes in, right, they have this scene, and then they're out, and then it just moves on to the rest of the plot.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, can't remember exactly how old I was, certainly a sort of youngish teenager, I think, when I first really watched it. And I think this was the only... The telegram in this, and I only thought telegrams existed because the Queen sent them for 100th birthday, and Carmen and her brother from Mexico have sent a telegram to the Three Amigos, where, and there's the, you know, we've already had the amusing scene where you're paying per word and they can't afford it, so right, let's condense it down, and this is the whole sort of, say, confusion around the word infamous.
Infamous.
You know, you've got the person typing the telegram, oh yeah, it means murderous, evil and all that, and then you've got Martin Short going, it means more than famous. It's, and again, that's probably how I learned that word, and I'm still don't know which is the exact meaning. They break back into the lot because they've been booted out, and this is one of those things where they live in the studio mansion wearing studio clothes. They break back in and steal their old costumes.
The bird calls.
I mean, it's just these visual gags, you know, again, in a film that, I mean, it's what, about 100 minutes long. And there's all these little things that, you know, again, it is a silly film. There are gags in here that are, could quite happily pop up anywhere. And yet it's, just, you know, you've got Steve Martin standing on a wall doing bird calls down at the two lads just sitting and going, completely ignorant. Yeah. I mean, you could see that quite easily transfer into The Inbetweeners or something like that. It's just that universal.
Yeah, I mean, there is nothing new about those gags. It's just, even then, it was just funny. It was just, right, yeah, starting off with these exotic bird calls and then just basically thinly disguises, hey, you guys, look up here.
We cut to Mexico. Now, this is... now, Santa Poco is the sort of village where Carmen, this is being terrorized by the infamous El Guapo, which my Spanish isn't great, but apparently means, is it the handsome one or something like that?
I don't know about that, but yeah. So if you say so, I'll go with it.
Yeah, well, that's what Google translates it anyway. It's like a Jose Mourinho thing. And you've got a cantina, which we've had already, where Carmen and the brother were looking for recruits. And it's a cantina in a Western, I mean, this is a Western ripoff almost, but it's a cantina. This is where you're going to get, you know, whether it's Mos Eisley or Blazing Saddles or The Magnificent Seven or Back to the Future 3, it's a cantina where the scum of the earth hang out. And you've got a German in 1916 walking in there with a leather flying hat on. I mean, of course, he comes across as terrifying.
Yes, he is brilliant, and then he just shoots the place up, which is hilarious in itself. Shoots it up for the first time, anyway. And the greatest thing about that one scene is when all the bodies are lying around, and then all of a sudden you see the cleanup team come in and take away the bodies, put in a new table, and there are new customers ready to sit at that table, like they've been waiting to replace the guys who've just been shot.
I imagine that's like something what happens at Disney World. Someone froze up in the canteen.
It's like Westworld. I mean, like, you know,
yeah.
It's the recent series of Westworld would have had that stuff on, and it would have been a really sort of like there would have been a deeper meaning to it. But no, not in Three Amigos. This is funny. This is actually a funny thing that you're probably going to miss. You're not going to see anyway. But it's there just for anyone who's out there noticing.
I wonder if Westworld was one of the films they actually thought about when they did that, being a Western.
It may well have been. I mean, there was. It's a classic, isn't it? So yeah. I would have thought so. I would think that something like that is probably a favourite of Landis.
Yeah. And we get the, I suppose, again, like, you know, this is fish out of water. This next scene is all about the mistaken identity when the German says, you know, I've got friends coming. They're not as nice. You know, this is like Darth Vader saying he's not as forgiving as I am. And then you've got the three amigos walk in full garb, and just the tequila, the piano, I'd never heard My Little Buttercup before I'd seen this. And it's just everything about it, because everyone in the bar is terrified of these guys because the German said to be. Oh, just everything. I mean, it's a trio. It's a, you know, fantastic. They're entertainers and they're putting on a show for these guys. It's just this. That is probably my favorite part of the film already.
And when they're getting them all to like join in with the song, and the Mexican guy says "Esmile," it's brilliant. I love that. And they're all like really scared for their lives, and allowing them to go through this ridiculous song and dance routine, which yeah is obviously ridiculous. This is I think this was an original song written by Randy Newman, so he went to town on it, didn't he?
And the fact that, you know, that there are those sort of throwaway comments. Was it when they go in and they say, oh, where's the hotel? There isn't one. And Ned said, oh, I could kill someone. And, you know, I mean, I suppose it's almost a parody of any American abroad where it's like, oh, have you got a beer? No, we've got tequila. Is it fattening? You can imagine. They go into Weatherspoon's in Leicester Square. Oh, I keep saying Weatherspoon. I must stop saying Weatherspoon. Asking if their sort of guest ale is what the calorie count is or something like that. we get a gag that I'd never noticed before at all. And when they're outside and this German plane flies over and Martin Short says, oh, it's a mail plane. Did you see that? I'd never paid attention to that before. And I laughed it tickled me, and it shouldn't have done, but... Probably because I've seen this film 50 times. It's the first time I've really noticed that joke.
No, that was funny. No, well, yeah.
What is that?
It's a plane.
It's not just any plane. It's a Tupman 601.
I flew one and little Nettie goes to war.
What's it doing here?
I think it's a mail plane.
How can you tell?
Well, didn't you notice its little balls?
And yes, I'm laughing at it right now. Yes, and the next time I watch it, I'll laugh again out loud. Don't care.
And at this point, the Germans' two friends do turn up in suits and. When the cantina clientele were quite, they were quick to dismiss these guys. They were so quick to fear the amigos and quick to dismiss these guys. I think they call them sissies as soon as they walked in. Yeah, another shootout in shoes. So when the amigos, they finally bump into Carmen, I suppose their client, some gags that go throughout the films. You've got three amigos, so they've got three men on one horse. As they get led back to the village, silly things where they're really sort of pushing. I mean, that when they share a bed, there's the three of them in one bed. It's, you know, rustic setting. But, I mean, in terms of your hired guns, I mean, that's how you treat them.
It's interesting about the fact that they're on the I think it's a mule they're actually on, but the horse riding thing was actually led to one of the casting decisions in this, because I think originally it was John Candy that was slated to be in Ned's role, but he was too fat to ride a horse, so he couldn't be in it.
Blimey! Imagine how different would things have been. They might have just cast him anyway.
The casting of this was all over the place because it was the first time he came up with it was in 1980, and I think the original cast was going to be Steve Martin, Dan Aykroyd, and John Belushi. So you got Steve Martin and the Blues Brothers basically, and what sort of film would that have been? But it's interesting when you look at those sort of films, those Saturday Night Live films that came out during the 80s, how many of them were scheduled to have John Belushi in, but of course he died in 82, so it was due to be in Ghostbusters, Spies Like Us, all these films that came out, and he wasn't, and so other people went in there and other people made their careers off it.
Yeah, because I did see the name Bill Murray was I think at one point considered or involved in this as well. And, you know, again, I guess that's the way these sort of things work in that time with a benefit of history. You can look back and think, you know, any one of 10 or 15 names could have been dropped into one of those roles and it would have probably still worked, albeit in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at all those names, there is always a list of something that says, well, actually, he was in this film at the same time, so he didn't do too badly by not being in this.
Yeah, scheduling conflicts are always the thing, but I suppose those guys are probably quite busy. And, you know, I mean, even so, I mean, you know, for all of the things that didn't happen, and, you know, these projects usually, or often, you find out in history, take years to get onto the screen. But I think that the chemistry between the three, and I mean, we'll come across it later on, I think particularly around the campfire scene.
Yes.
It was it worked really well. And I mean, even if Ned is, and probably the way it was written, was seen as kind of the younger one, almost the baby. But it worked really well.
Oh, totally.
When they get to the village, this is, you know, we're still in the fantasy where the Amigos think they've been hired to put on a show, you know, to scare off the infamous El Guapo. And when we see, you know, they turn up and these three, I always call them goons, arrive. Yeah,
that's a suitable term for them. I think they're Goon 1, Goon 2 and Goon 3 turn up, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to love the personal touch of hired goons.
Homer, I hope Crusher and Low Blow didn't hurt you.
You know, you could have just called me.
Oh, yes, but the telephone is so impersonal. I prefer the hands-on touch you only get with hired goons.
Hired goons?
And they literally are getting ready for a performance, and they go out and they recite the lines from the films that we've already seen, you know, and calling them the things I always remember, someone being called the son of a motherless goat.
Motherless goat. yes, and you see, and of course you see this the salute as well.
That salute. I'm sure when I saw this, and there were probably people at school or whatever the next day doing that salute in the playground. And I mean, I say if they did it now, I mean, it's probably the equivalent of doing flossing or whatever kids do. But, you know, there's these lines and they're giving this stuff that, and it is them doing a performance because that's what they hired to do. So they've got the confidence, these three goons, with their sort of pillaged tequila, are sitting there going, oh, you know, what's going on? And they ride off, and all of a sudden it is party time. It's, my God, we've beat we've beat El Guapo, we've shooed him away. El Guapo's not even there. And I suppose, I mean, it'd be a very short movie if that was the case, but, you know, we all know they're still living in this fantasy bubble. And yet, you know, it's a big old party. I mean, there's fireworks and Steve Martin doing tricks with a lasso. It's, you know, it's all very jovial.
Yes, it is. And it sort of builds it all up, doesn't it? And I suppose this is what this type of film does. This is the template it's writing, because you see the same thing happen in Galaxy Quest afterwards as well, where you can see that initially it seemed to be a success, but what happens is they make things ridiculously worse.
And I think that's easily done, I suppose, if you know, when you look back at, I mean, obviously there are links to the Magnificent Seven and everything else, but when you look back at you know, having recently rewatched the Dollars trilogy, you know, when the sort of mysterious stranger, albeit under different circumstances, comes in and shoos off some goons, and all of a sudden it's, oh no, Big Boss is going to come. And but yeah. You know, I mean, that's, you know,
it's classic Western trope, isn't it? Yeah,
it is. But it works well, and the fact that they have the, I mean, even some of the lines in here. I mean, one of the girls says to Chevy Chase, you know, "Kiss me on the veranda." He says, "Oh, the lips will do fine."
I mean, that is a telegraphed line. You can see it coming from a mile off. But you know what? You don't care. You just don't care. When she says, "Kiss me on the veranda," you know that's just a gimme, isn't it? Who cares? We're all here for that one.
Take the baseball cap. He's Clark Griswold still. I mean, that's perfectly out of one of the vacation films. Apparently, Steve Martin actually could do those lasso tricks when he had a job at Disney World.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That is quite impressive if you can remember them. But yeah, I mean, you know, we've had this party. And I just love the way they introduce El Guapo when the goons ride back to tell him what's happened. And he's lining up this photograph.
Yeah.
Of a scene, and he's sitting again. We will gut them and, you know, squeeze the shit out of them. But let me take this photograph first. Very George Bush Fahrenheit 9/11 type thing.
No, very, very. Yeah, it is, and it sets it up perfectly. And then you've got him introduced as Alfonso Arro, and he is brilliant in this. He is absolutely amazing. He just, I think he's a legend of Mexican cinema. But I'm no expert on Mexican cinema at all. But obviously, he's someone who's not only an actor but a filmmaker as well.
I think, you know, when you talk about him, the way that he's played, you know, obviously in a comedy, but that they've got that balance right between him being funny and him being, say, evil. We don't see a lot of the evil. He talks about it a lot, but we don't see it. But he's just that kind of, they've just got him exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, no, certainly. I mean, he could turn up in any film. And, there's almost a touch of the Hans Gruber's about him, isn't there? He's just brilliant, isn't he?
You know, when he turns up the next morning at the village, and, again, you know, he's confused initially. You know, in a way, I mean, Hans Gruber's a perfect example. The way that, you know, he's met with someone pretending to be a cowboy in John McClane. You think, Lucky Day comes up to him and says, "It's a pleasure working with you," as though he, you know, treating him as a legend of Mexican cinema. You know, they go for the whole routine again, and suddenly they get shot in the arm and goes up and sort of chastises the is it Jefe, the right hand man. That reminded me of like Rick Mayall in Bottom, the way he did that. Like, "Just you look at me."
Well, if you're a big Steve Martin fan, him getting shot in the left arm is funny in itself, because if you've seen Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which is one of his finest films, he gets shot repeatedly in the left arm throughout the film, and it's just one of the recurring jokes that he's going through. He's like pulling bullets out of his left arm, and the fact that he gets shot in the left arm this time is just that's another laugh that just isn't meant to be there, I don't think, but it's a laugh anyway.
Yeah, and it works again. It's just, you know, showing that these things, I mean, they probably have been considered at some point, and they've gone, "Yeah, leave it. Yeah, that's a good idea. Leave that in. That'll look good on IMDb."
Yeah, they'll recognise it. But I think that's the thing, is because the obviously Short, Martin and Chase have all come from Saturday Night Live, where they've got recurring characters in different situations. So they will be doing things that there will be running gags that will stitch them all together. So it's very much in that Saturday Night Live spirit. And like you say, like with Chase's line, "Kiss me on the veranda," is very much Griswold. It could be from another film, but it's him. It's Chase is bringing this to this film this time.
It's very much the SNL cinematic universe, I think.
Yeah.
bring it into modern parlance. I think...
it'd be great if they had teaser trailers right at the end, wouldn't it? In every one of them. To get you on to the next one.
It'd still be Samuel L. Jackson, though, wouldn't it? Now, at this point, after he's been shot in the arm, they suddenly twig, you know, real bullets. Oh, this is real. And it is that realisation of, oh, dear, you know, what have we got ourselves into? And it is almost that part of the fish out of water thing that you mentioned earlier, where there is the realization that they've got in too deep, you know, or the fish has come out too far, or however, I've probably completely ruined that. but, you know, they ride off, they go away in the horses, and yet they still come back. The village has been raped and pillaged and everything else. And they come back and it's like, la, 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 you've forgiven us now. And it's like, no, they've taken our daughter and they've blown our church up, and, you know, exactly what they do in Westerns. You know, how many have you seen? You've made several.
yes. And, have you seen my cufflinks anywhere?
Poor rich men in Mexico stranded.
Yeah. But it makes the perfect midway point in the film, doesn't it? Because this is them at their lowest point. Because they can't go home. They've got nothing here, and they've not all their money that they thought they were going to get to buy their car or travel or start an orphan charity. It's not going to happen, and so they couldn't get any lower, could they, at this point? Which Landis does really well, because this is timed in the exact midpoint of the film. So you've got the whole second half of the film for the redemption story.
But yeah, I mean, like you said, this works, you know, is a Landis thing. I mean, it obviously works in other films, but here it's got that scene where Ned is the one who says, you know, we need to stand up, and there is, you know, draws the line in the sand, you know, just to make it quite clear, you know, this isn't a metaphor. and they do sort of join him, because again, it's like you say, that they're rock bottom. What else have they got to lose? We might die. But then, you know, as they make clear in the film, you know, our reward is that justice has been done, even though sort of Chevy Chase always has a little bit of a, I could do with the money. I'll have a night at Hammersmith Apollo. Don't you worry. And I say we're at the midpoint of the film, so because, you know, essentially they're pretty much responsible for the daughter being kidnapped, Carmen, and they have to go and rescue her, and we get the scene or the act of them. I mean, they make it look like it is a long way away. I mean, it's not exactly made clear, but they have to go, and they have the campfire. And that campfire scene's fantastic, and I always love
it. It is brilliant. Yeah. It is brilliant, because as well, what it does is it really builds this whole thing of when it's the three of them, when they're in their own little bubble, like when they were in the bed earlier, when they're in their own little bubble, it turns into their film. It's under their control. And so it turns into this sort of Disney-esque fantasy. And the set is perfect for it, because it's got this painted backdrop, and I love painted backdrops in a film that are meant to be like a real sky. I think and the cactuses are so obviously fake, but everything about it is just cheesy and yeah, not real. And you've got the tortoise there as well, which is brilliant. And then this lovely song that they come up with, another Randy Newman song, and it's just. It is so spot on, and it really warms you to them again. I mean, and then you really do see the magic there between the warmth between the three of them. And obviously they worked for a long time on Saturday Night Live, but these are three stellar comedians, three really good comic actors, and they just work so well together.
Yeah, I mean, the song was it Randy Newman? Did he sing the Chevy Chase part? Oh, sounded like it anyway.
I don't know whether whether Chevy Chase. I mean, like, he's very good at lip syncing. Remember the "You Can Call Me Al" video?
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know if he did or not. I think that might have been Chase, but it probably was. It may not. It does sound a lot like Randy Newman though, so maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Newman did star as the singing bush, as we'll come to. But I mean that part. I mean, like you say, that there is that sort of bond between the three. and it worked. I mean, the song is great. It has, you know, the animals popping up, you know, like something out of a completely different type of movie popping up. And yeah, I mean, the whole thing, you know, where they are treating old little Ned, look at him, you know, he's tuckered out, he's tight, you know, they're the old hats. And it is like, you know, yes, they're the three amigos, but he's the baby and they're looking after him, and he's never slept outside before, and they're the veterans. And that just works so well that, you know, that's something that could go wrong. I think if you have three actors, three egos, however you put it, if you don't get that balance right, if you don't get that blend, it looks a bit weird. And this is, you know, to go off on a different tangent, if you remember, do you remember that scene in The Expendables where they had Schwarzenegger, Stallone and Willis, and it was the first time they'd ever all been on camera, and they were just so ridiculously stunted, and it was just them sort of butting heads. There was nothing there.
No, nothing at all.
Yeah, and yet this was a completely different scenario. You just warm to them, and everything you think about them, they're cowards, they ran away, they took the, well, they wanted to take the peso and run, they didn't understand, and you instantly go back into on their side if you were ever off it. And yeah, I mean, the music was just incredible as well. I mean, you know, I know Bernstein did the Magnificent Seven theme, and that was what, probably exactly why he was hired, but having that score and Randy Newman, and you know, Randy Newman, a lot of people know him from everything from the, you know, Toy Story and all that, but it's so distinctive and it just fits this film absolutely spot on.
Yeah, it does. It gives it that sort of, these guys are the sort of guys who will burst into song. They will make a film a musical if they want to, because that's just what they do. The whole thing about the story is of course that they're three actors thrust in a real world situation, but they're not. They're just three actors they're three characters in one film that are thrown into a slightly different type of film. And that's all it is. And I suppose that's what this scene does. As I say, when everyone else is away from it, they're allowed to sort of make it their own again. So they come up with this song and dance routine with singing horses in, and it's just brilliant with the animated mouths. Ah, yeah. Mwah.
And again, you know, after this, you know, when they do fall asleep, you've got, again, just sort of the I would say easy gags, but they work so well. They're riding on horseback, you know. Steve Martin's canteen has a couple of drops. Martin Schultz is full of sand, and Chevy Chase's is an endless reservoir that gets wasted and thrown away as they look desperately at it seeping out into the sand. It's just the way he portrays it.
Yeah, and brilliant, because as well, you know, these are the whole thing about them being silent film stars, and you've got a pretty much silent set scene there. A comic sketch without any words in at all, but it's just perfect. You've got the rule of three there, where you've got three situations. You have the normal one, the slightly drained canteen. Then you've got the ridiculous one, the sand one, and then it gets even more ridiculous, which is the constantly flowing one, when it's just on the ground and the water is just going between the cracks. Everything about that is just hilarious, and you just keep laughing at it, because no matter what he does, I don't know how long he does it, but he's when he's swilling his mouth out, and when he gets the lip balm out as well, of course, yeah, then it breaks it from being silent into lip balm.
And again, you like contrast that. I mean, they did a similar, it didn't work quite the same way in Spaceballs, where they would say, oh, water, oil, room service, as they were sort of what they were desperately after as they were traipsing through the dunes of this desert. Just watching their faces was like when I sit in front of one of my kids eating an ice cream and they haven't got one. They're sitting there looking at me desperately, hoping I'll share as I get to the end and offer them half a banana or something.
Yeah. Yeah, these are the reasons why they won't visit you when you're in your 70s.
Yeah, well, that's all right. I'll dress up as Superman and climb up on a public building. So as part of their quest, the Amigos reach the singing bush, which is exactly how it sounds.
She'll be riding six white horses when she comes. She'll be riding six white horses. She'll be riding six white horses. She'll be riding six white horses when she comes.
Excuse me.
Come on,
are you the singing bush?
Follow the sea with a yo-ho, we'll blow the man down. Oh, pay attention and listen.
Let me talk to him.
Excuse us. Are you the singing bush?
Yo-ho, blow the man down. Yo-ho, blow the man down.
Hello?
Yo-ho,
hi.
Blow the man down.
Hi.
Give me some time to blow the man down.
Excuse us!
Good night, ladies.
Hey!
Good night, ladies. Good night, ladies. We're gonna leave you now. Merrily we
forget
along,
it. My guess
along,
is this is the singing bush.
This to me is straight out of Python. This is Python-esque, this whole scene. Because there is absolutely no need for it to be in the film. They just put this in because they wanted to do this. Because it is something you would have expected to see in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But here it is in this, it's an American comedy. And there is no plot reason for it to be here. But it's just damn funny.
It's a landmark. All it is when you get to the singing bush. It's like when you get to the crossroads or when you get to the junction of this. But you're in the desert. It's, oh, when you get to the singing bush, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yes, it's a singing bush. And it's Randy Newman singing bush.
Yes.
How could you miss it? When you get to the singing bush, you've got to summon the invisible swordsman, which sounds like something out of the Viz Profanosaurus. And again, it is Steve Martin and Martin Short doing, you have to chant something out of their notebook and fire a shot in the air. Again, it's those two doing one thing and Chevy Chase half-assed going la 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 la, yodeling in the way that he does. And needless to say, because it's an invisible man, of course, he shoots the invisible man and it's the sight gag of invisible man falling into sand.
And I fall with that fellow. Rick, you killed the invisible swordsman!
He's dead, all right.
How was I supposed to know where he was?
You were supposed to fire up.
We both fired up.
It's like living with a six-year-old.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. You see, that's the payoff of the whole thing. He's an invisible swordsman. What the hell are they going to do with this? And he's like, man, he's just got to die. That's all he's got to do.
He's got to die, fall into sand, and then you wonder if this was on the books when Chevy Chase played. Was it Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
Yeah. They probably thought, hey, Invisible Man films, I'm going to be in one of these days.
That looks like fun. Just completely fortuitously, the same plane flies overhead and it's, ooh, I bet he's going to El Guapo's.
Of course.
Why else would a German plane be flying in that part of Mexico? I don't know. And we get in, because this is El Guapo's 40th birthday, the whole point of this celebration that they're going towards. It's now I turned 40 this year and I didn't have a celebration quite this much. I certainly didn't have a plethora of piñatas.
I have put many beautiful piñatas in the storeroom, each of them filled with little surprises.
Many piñatas?
Oh yes, many!
Would you say I have a plethora of piñatas?
A what?
A plethora.
Oh, yes. You have a plethora.
Jefe, what is a plethora?
Why, Guapo?
Well, you told me I have a plethora. And I just would like to know if you know what a plethora is. I would not like to think that a person would tell someone he has a plethora and find out that that person has no idea what it means to have a plethora.
Plethora of piñatas. Of course, we get to meet Jefe a bit here, doesn't he? He has a bit of a conversation with El Guapo, and it's actually a very warm exchange, actually, apart from when El Guapo tries to put him down for not knowing what plethora means. But the guy who plays him is a guy called Tony Planner. I think he's a Cuban actor. And Do you recognise him from another film with an exclamation mark at the end?
You're going to say it's like Top Secret or something?
No. Goal.
Go on.
He's Santiago's dad in Goal.
Oh, no. I've wiped that from my brain.
Well, yeah, you're going to have to go and watch it again now, aren't you? Just to see him, aren't you?
I'll put that on the Patreon. Yeah. Oh, wow. I didn't realise that, because I saw I did one of the IMDb trivia pieces where apparently he turned down a role in an Oliver Stone film to play this role, and he and Oliver Stone were mates and fell out because he was like, well, why would you go and do that silly thing? Weird.
I think some of his scenes in it are fantastic. I mean, because we get to see more of Alfonso Arau and this whole conversation about his birthday and similar. You know, I think you're more worried about the fact that you're turning 40. You know, and the fact that they buy him a sweater or they knit him a sweater or something. It's just perfect.
I think this or their relationship is something that is kind of, I wouldn't say lacking from other films, but it certainly develops things in a way that the role or the bond between the head villain and the henchman or the chief goon.
Yeah.
We've watched a lot of Bond films. We've grown up watching these films where Hefe is trying to make El Guapo feel like the big man. He's like, oh, yes, you have a plethora of piñatas. And then it's only then that they have that conversation, you know, because he's trying to build his ego.
Yeah,
and it's only when he's kind of pulled up on it, but he speaks the truth to him, and it's in a way that you don't normally expect.
No, and it's lovely, all the more lovely for it as well. And it is a great scene, that one, and it's an easily forgotten one because it's funny on such a simple level, and it just keeps the sort of comedy value just bubbling under without needing a belly laugh.
No, and again, it works, you know, they're talking, and this is like two young guys talking about, oh, my girlfriend won't sleep with me, you know, because they've kidnapped a woman. And it's like, you cannot force open the petals of the flower. And it's like this kind of, it all sounds really romantic. It's like, I want to make her fall in love with me. And then it's all of a sudden, it suddenly twists. It's like, oh, what if she won't open her flower to you tonight? Then I'll kill her. Yeah, that's. I mean, I don't know how many 40th birthday parties go that way, but that's just a sort of sign of the sinister side of El Guapo. But you know, we've got the Germans pulling up with these guns, and you know, all he wants for his birthday is guns. So you know, fair play to him. I mean, we're in that continent. The Amigos have sneaked in to the complex. I call it complexes, and you know, again, it's visual comedy. They're swinging in on the ropes that the piñatas are stranded up on, and it's
which is brilliant.
Three different ways of doing something, you know, that, and they do it three different ways. It works
well, of course. I mean, again, you get the rule of three going on there. You get one that's near perfect, all right, it just ends up going straight into the very room that they needed to go in. Then you get one that it's okay, but they get stuck. Mm, okay, and then you hit Steve Martin comes down, falls flat on his face. Brilliant.
I guess it's one of those scenes, like, it was almost like the other part of Beverly Hills Cop where Axel Foley gets all these guns pulled on him. This was Steve Martin getting guns pulled on him, and then...
And Blazing Saddles as well. There's almost exact same scene, isn't there, in there, with the guns pointing at him. And the whole, seize him! It's perfect, yeah.
And he gets taken off into this dungeon, and he's almost talking to these goons as though they should unionize.
Yeah. You should say, yeah, well, under a federal government, you'd be free to own property.
I mean, you know, there's this, that's just kind of, he has his very elaborate prison cell where he's kept held that just gives him his own little thing to do while the others are trying to rescue the day. You know, it's hard to describe, but every chain that he's chained up in is hooked to a weight.
It looks like an old exercise machine, isn't it, basically?
He's pulling and he's got to get to this lever, and it's like the guy in the cell in Life of Brian where he's praying to get spat on. It's like that cell, and he's slightly cleaner. Dusty is in disguise, as in, I say disguise, he just changes his hat and puts on a poncho. And
yep, so the, good enough.
But the whole, you know, as you say, Guapo gets given a sweater for his gift. He says, "I know you all like you're my brother," and you get the again. It's that you know, he's a rule of three, isn't it? He, you know, he talks to three people, and he knows two of them very well. Chevy Chase's idea of sort of fitting in was he burned the villages, raped the horses, rode the women,
and prune the hedges.
I mean, it's just an excuse for him to put on a slight accent of some sort. Yeah. And all this while we said Ned's been suspended because the spurs of his boots got stuck in a piñata, just hanging on. And it's just the obvious payoff. I mean, it's...
Gringos are falling from the sky.
Half a second later, there he goes, landing on the table. It's a silly gag, but we love it.
Yeah, of course.
It's like the shit hitting the fan in Airplane. Except no one
expected that. It is. I think that gag is a good benchmark for if you're going to like this film or not. I think if you watch that gag, even if you slightly chuckle, then the rest of the film will be fine. If that just leaves you dead and you think, oh God, yeah, right, okay, then don't bother spending an hour and 40 minutes on this film because, you know, there's a piece of your soul is dead. So you're just not going to enjoy it.
Yeah, go and watch one of those art house films or something like
that. Yeah, go and do that. Yeah.
I mean, as you said, if it's a film with an exclamation mark in the title, that's all you need to know. In fact, it's got two, hasn't it?
It's got the inverted one as well. Yeah, and of course, Airplane had an exclamation mark on the end. I mean, is that what you think I am now? Someone who comes on and reviews films with exclamation marks in them.
Do you want to do Goal?
I'm not doing Goal.
Yeah, I need to do Top Secret as well, actually. That'll probably be slightly more fun. Yes. I suppose one of the payoffs of having movie stars out of their depth in this situation is that one of them might be recognised by a wandering German arms dealer, suddenly decides that he recognises Ned Niederlander and challenges him to a duel.
Yeah, which another thing it allows us to have some more visual gags, doesn't it? When they swap his gun over and give him this huge cannon, cast iron cannon to hold.
And even when he wins the duel, he shoots first because of this gun. It's just that easy. Oh, there he goes. He's flying backwards.
Yeah. Yeah, just killed a man. But I don't know, let's get a gag out of it.
Yeah, it's his first duel. He's got a gun three times the size of him, and he manages to win. I mean, that's the German disposed of. Yeah, Lucky's escaped from his prison cell. They have a very sort of... I mean, you're wondering, all these Mexican bandits understand English very well when they're giving them the orders to lay down. Although El Guapo kind of encourages them to do it still.
Yeah, it is all sort of done very, very well. Of course, just to keep the plot going, though, really, isn't it? Like, but, you know, it's funny and it works well and it allows them to escape for it's the very, great finale.
It's very sporting.
Yes.
And again, fortunately, that plane's there and Ned's stunt double flew one. So we get, again, just a 90 seconds or so of really, really bad biplane flying.
Well, God, yeah, and as well, I thought, really, John? John Landis, what are you doing? You've got another low-flying aircraft here. I really, really don't think this should be in the film at all. Make sure all those child actors are very, very far away from that set, okay?
I don't know, those Mexican actors, well, I suppose it was filmed in the US, but they're saying Mexican actors were probably cheaper and more expendable. Controversial there, yeah. So I may have happened across that in a memo from one of the meetings they had. Now, the finale where they fly back to the village being chased by El Guapo and his cast of goons. This is, again, if you're being hired by a village to solve their problems with a bandit, they're not going to be expert marksmen or expert swordsmen or anything else. When they suddenly decide, what is it that you do really well? So... you've basically come across an army of seamstresses.
Yep. And it works, and they've got all their Singer sewing machines working away, and you don't know what they're doing. It's all like lots of black material being used, and it's oh, wow, what they're doing, digging holes as well, and it is great. This is the montage scene, isn't it? The one where they're really preparing for the final battle, and it works really well. Got everything so like the wind.
I did think, and again, you know, sometimes with these films, just don't think at all. It's just easier. I mean, they must have had a hefty store of all this black material.
Yes, must have done.
For the next invasion, when the, you know, I mean, I'm sure they had other colours were available too, but they had all this available.
This is the returning thing of the film, is when they're in charge. It becomes their fantasy, doesn't it? And their fantasy is the one that wins out. So of course there's enough sewing machines. Of course there's enough material. So of course there are enough hats.
And the fact that they film this scene, and of course it looks like there's 40 or 50 amigos running around firing shots at the gang. And every time you see it, there's a gag where I think one of them is stood to the side of this small building, and at least six or seven run inside the one door, and they're all dressed in these really elaborate, they are wearing Three Amigos costumes.
Yeah. And it's only at the end as well.
When you see, you know, it's all the silver, the sequins, all the jewellery. Yeah. It's only at the end when you see they're all wearing black suits with a bit of white tape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it. I mean, like you know, it is this whole fantasy of clever editing, of not so clever editing, works here, where every time you see them, they are clearly, it's clearly Steve Martin and Chevy Chase and Martin Short. they're still going through with it, and it's brilliant. They don't try and sell it any other way, and that's why it works so well. That's why it's funny.
It's almost like they're putting us in the eyes of El Guapo and the villains. All we see are amigos.
Yes, exactly. All we see are those things. The same guys are here, there and everywhere.
I mean, most of the goons end up riding off and El Guapo screaming, you know, at them, the cowards, and he gets shot. So the villagers all kind of gather around him. And, I mean, you do wonder, this is kind of, and again, putting it in a slightly different context, this is the evil mastermind, the head of a criminal syndicate. You know, you've cut the head off the snake. Do all those goons go off into other jobs? You know, do they go and work somewhere else? El Guapo is left to die, although he still gets a shot in on Lucky's foot. But, you know, again, El Guapo has been removed. You're leaving a power vacuum at the head of this crime. You know, who's going to step in?
Well, exactly. I mean, like, there was no exit strategy there, was there at all? And for me, it just ruined the whole film.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think we should rewrite that, and, you know, it's like, again, go back to a Bond film. You know, we'll say, oh, well, he's just the head of one part. There's actually a bigger syndicate going up. You've got, you know, this is just Spectre. Oh, fuck it. I'm not even going to go on to Spectre. I've got View to a Kill's on in the background. Fuck it. Just enjoy that. Which one's Zorin? And this is again a Western thing. The amigos kiss the girls. Martin Short gets the one who's credited in the credits as Hot Senorita.
Yes, Miss June 86 in Playboy.
It's the 80s. Do what you want. It's fine. No one will mind. They kiss the girls. It's less riding and off into the sunset. It's What a film.
And you know, it's been almost as enjoyable just talking about it. It's brought it all back.
Getting to watch it again, and the film ends again with that original song, them holding the note at the end, and then going off into some more Bernstein epic scoring.
Worked for me.
I mean, there's one thing I didn't mention, and again, this is almost, you know, at one point this was becoming an obligatory podcast mention, is that when I did the episode about the, do you remember the Ewok movies?
Yes.
Yeah.
Caravan of Courage.
Yes. They were actually scored by Elmer Bernstein's son.
Oh, were they?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
So, yeah. I mean, looking at his career. He did a John Candy film. It was Canadian Bacon, although that was the one. Was that the one he died? He was filming that when he died. Yeah, we'll stick with Elmer. I'll go through his back catalogue and see for your next appearance if he did any other films with exclamation marks in them.
Yeah, I think that seems to be my role now on this podcast, doesn't it, really?
Yes, and you know, in the way that you segue nicely on the Sound of Football podcast into the upcoming week's box set, you segue nicely into the Sound of Football podcast, which is what I'd like to think most people that listen to this will know, and of you and Jan and Terry and former Sound of Football alumni Chris Oakley have been involved in this. What can people get from the Sound of Football that they don't get on any of the plethora of other football podcasts that are out there?
Yes, well, you might think that if you're listening to the Sound of Football that you'd just be listening to three middle-aged white guys who are a bit jaded with football. But no, wait, we're more than just that, I think. We've been doing it for ages, so we do find other stuff to talk about. Now, we try not to get caught up too much in the whole song and dance of football, but when the song and dance of football is hilarious and we can find a few things to laugh at, then yes, we'll certainly get involved with that. But yes, it's football, but not that serious.
And I think since you were last on, I did guest on there talking about the very fun Aussie Rules movie, The Club.
We that was great, because that was actually, I think, about a year ago to the day almost that we're recording this. And you kind of came on, and we did Sound of Football Does Betamax Video Club. It was a joy to do that, and what a film. What a film.
That was a treat.
I like to include that as an unofficial episode of your podcast there, Rich.
Yeah, it's very much a spin-off, and is that still available on Amazon Prime? Well, I don't have Amazon Prime anymore.
The Club, ooh. I think it probably is. I don't know. Yes. Yeah, it was on Amazon Prime. I can't see why they would have shifted it off there.
No.
I mean, our downloads alone would have thought, people like it, so there you go.
Well, we'll have to take that off. I'm sure Netflix will be bidding them billions of dollars just for the rights. And as we also have as a tradition on this podcast, the song that was number one in the UK when this was released, now, as you mentioned earlier, it was summer 1987. It was June the 12th. And the number one song was I Want to Dance with Somebody, which, as I had to double check, I hadn't played before. Although, like you said, I mean, there's so many. Oh, I should put some Randy Newman in, really, at the end, shouldn't I?
Yes. Well, you know, only you can do that. You're in charge of the buttons there, Rich.
It's a rich tapestry there. No. Anyway, Graham, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rich. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm doing my Three Amigos salute. Let's ride.
So am I. From the sky above, you know pretty soon that big yellow moon will light the way back to the one you love. Blue shadows on the train. Little cowboy, close your eyes and dream. All of the doggies are in the corral. All of your work is done. Just close your eyes and dream, little pal. Dream all. Someone.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal,
Philip Rothenberger, Alan Fewings, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, Simon Pegg, Joe Harrison, Anita Singh, and Jason Clarkson, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.